This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to New York, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water, this land was made for you.
And welcome to the People Speak Radio. This is your host, David Swanson. We are very privileged to have with us as a guest for the next hour, Helena Coban, who is, among other things, the author of what I think is really a terrific new book called Re-Engage, America and the World After Bush. Helena is originally from the UK. She now calls Charlottesville, Virginia, home, as I do. And she has been a journalist, has traveled the world. She works in Washington, D.C. for the Friends Committee on National Legislation. And she writes for the Christian Science Monitor, among other things. And she has a wonderful blog herself. And she can tell you the address of that and about her new book. Helena, thanks for coming to the People Speak Radio.
You're very welcome. It's nice to be with you.
Remind me the address of your website.
It's www.justworldnews.org. That's all one word.
Justworldnews.org, with the emphasis on just, I take it.
That's right.
There is also a website, reengage.net, with a hyphen after the re, re-engage.net. And this book, Re-Engage, America and the World After Bush, I hope we can be rid of Bush tomorrow. If not, I hope we can be by January of 2009. But in any case, it's encouraging to see some serious thought on what we can do about restoring our relationships with the rest of the world. How long have you been thinking about these ideas in this book?
Well, in a sense, I've been thinking about, you know, how do we get out of the mess that we're in ever since the president took the country into Iraq, in the invasion of Iraq, which I saw at the time, you know, based on the decades of work that I've done in the Middle East, I saw it would be disastrous. I argued against it very forcefully in the Christian Science Monitor and elsewhere beforehand, but, you know, all those of us who know anything about the Middle East and who, you know, the vast majority of Middle East specialists saw that this would be just, you know, catastrophic for the U.S. and for the Iraqi people. And we were not listened to. We were, you know, completely marginalized from having any impact at all. And so once I saw how terrible it was going to be, I was thinking, you know, what on earth can we do after Iraq, you know, because this will end and things will be very different in the Middle East and in the rest of the world. And then I reframed it with my publisher. This book is published by Paradigm Publishers, who published my last book as well. And we reframed it as America and the World After Bush, because that will really give us, you know, a whole new opportunity to restore the relationship, to reweave the fabric of the relationship between the American people. We are, you know, 5% of the world's people, our relationship with the other 95% of humanity. And, you know, so basically for the past year or so, I've been working on the book, and the publishers did a fabulous job getting out a quality volume under tremendous time deadline, because, you know, books take a long time to produce. And they've published it at $14.95. You can get it a lot cheaper on Amazon. So, you know, I urge people to rush out and buy it.
I certainly second that. It's a wonderful book, and it strikes me as a good book both for the choir, for the people who were sick and tired of Bush before he ever took office, and for the remaining 15 or 20 or whatever percent it is of Americans who still worship every word that stumbles out of his mouth. And because it seems to be, you know, both a book that says we want peace, but seriously, here's how we get it, and a book that says terrorism really is something to worry about. Here's how we should worry about it instead of the way we've been worrying about it. What, who were you picturing as your audience when you were writing this?
Well, maybe I wasn't exactly picturing the, you know, 15% who still believe every word that comes out of Bush's mouth, but I do feel that there's a huge mass of people in this country who know in their guts that there is something wrong with the whole way that Bush has conducted foreign policy. You know, mainly his stress on militarism, his stress on unilateral action, his sort of arrogant strutting around the world, the whole mission accomplished thing, and, you know, majorly pissing off our allies around the world, traditional allies. So, you know, people know that there's something wrong, but perhaps they don't feel that they have the confidence to, you know, they don't have the jargon, they don't, you turn on your television and you see these predominantly white male screeching heads. You know, they're not even talking heads anymore. They're screeching heads. And they have, you know, all this jargon, and they throw around all this stuff about deterrence and counter-deterrence and I don't know what. And so, you know, the vast mass of the citizenry here, you know, Jane and Jose, American citizen, are sitting there thinking, you know, how can I have a voice? How can I say something? I don't necessarily have a command of all that jargon, but I know something is wrong. So this book is designed to be a tool for Jane and Jose, U.S. citizen, who want to engage in the argument nationally, who want to be able to say the right things to their congressmen, who want to be able to say, to ask the right questions of their congressional candidates. You know, how can we really get this relationship between us and the other 95% of humanity back on an even keel? So I'm hoping that this book will give that, let's say, the sort of the middle 70% of the country, the people who, you know, who are not out there already organizing, and the people who are what you might call the sort of irreconcilable pro-Bushies, but the other 70% in the middle, the people who really want to have a discussion about how we put this, how we repair this relationship. So, for example, I've got charts in there. I've got little boxes that, you know, explain things about human rights law and humanitarian law and things about biofuels, so that people can really, you know, take these tools out of the book and use them when they're having discussions with their neighbors, in their church group, in their community group, when they're asking questions of their congressional candidates or whatever. One of the most important charts I have in there, and I've actually updated it and put an updated version on the Re-Engage website, that's re-engage.net. One of the best charts is the chart on the fatalities from terrorist attacks worldwide from 1998 through 2007. Now, what I was using here was only the U.S. State Department's own figures. And in 2001, as we remember, because, of course, that was the year that we had 9/11, there were 5,256 fatalities worldwide from terrorism. And, you know, nearly 3,000 of those were the fatalities from the World Trade Towers and the Pentagon and the crash in Pennsylvania. So it was an abnormally and disturbingly large figure. But here's what really comes out when you look at the figures from the years after that, is that 2003, the year that George Bush invaded Iraq, it was higher than it had been in 2001, and then every year since 2003, it's gone up again and again and again, so that in 2007, the figure was 430% as high as it was in 2001. You know, it's multiplied by more than four times. That, you know, we are supposed to be fighting a war on terror, and the State Department's own figures tell us that it is catastrophically failing. We got to try something else. I just really think that chart is a kind of argument clincher.
In other words, terrorism is going up because of our, or at least during our, war on terrorism, as we call it. Let me tell people how to get in on this conversation, Helena. This is David Swanson at the People Speak Radio, and we're speaking with Helena Coban, who is the author of Re-Engage, America and the World After Bush. And you can call in with your comments and questions toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. and Canada at 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. Anywhere else in the world, 877-489-6350, 877-489-6350, or go submit your questions at thepeoplespeakradio.net. It's a very dramatic chart, actually, Helena, because in the past few years, the number shoots up from around 5,000 fatalities from terrorist attacks up to around 20,000. Correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression is that the consensus in U.S. So-called intelligence agencies is that this is not just coincidental with our war on terrorism and our occupation of Iraq, but in large part because of, that is, the occupation of Iraq is encouraging terrorism. Is
absolutely
that your conclusion?
Yes. I've worked on Middle East affairs since the mid-1970s, and I go very frequently to the Middle East. I speak Arabic. I've got, a wide network of friends and contacts and colleagues throughout the Middle East. I've been there numerous times since 9/11, and it's absolutely the case, and you can't argue against it, that the administration's invasion and occupation of Iraq has incubated thousands of terrorists who would not otherwise have been terrorists, and these are people who have killed Americans and non-Americans who are our friends around the world, and just innocent people they've killed. Now, the other aspect of the global war, so-called global war on terror, that I think has fostered a real hatred and distrust of the United States has been the way that Bush has used it to marginalize and seek to exclude and crush any party or movement or government with which he disagrees, particularly in the Middle East. And so that, that's the policy of not talking to Iran, but keeping, as they say, we'll keep all options on the table. When he says that, that includes the possibility of an American nuclear attack on Iran. He has never said that he would, he's not going to be the first one to launch a nuclear attack. He's never said that he will never use nuclear weapons against the Iranians. And he has an open policy of regime change in Iran. So, why we should expect the Iranians to sit down and listen to our concerns when he is threatening the core of their regime, it's quite illogical, The same with Hamas and Hezbollah. I know quite a lot about those two movements. They do a lot of things of which Americans rightly disapprove, of which I disapprove, and nearly all other Americans disapprove. But here's the thing: those two movements have also participated in democratic elections and won substantial number of seats in parliaments. They have real support from their people. So why can't we find a way to sit down, either directly or indirectly, with movements like that, which are very different from Al-Qaeda, and I can definitely explain the difference. Al-Qaeda doesn't have that sense of responsibility to a constituency. It doesn't have that proven mandate from a constituency that Hamas and Hezbollah and the government of Iran all have. So, the old-fashioned way, the way that has worked throughout the centuries, is if you have a disagreement or a criticism with another government, you find a way, a diplomatic way, to sit down and talk with them. Doesn't mean that you sell the store. It doesn't mean you sell anything. It means you say, we've got concerns about your actions. We gather that you have concerns about our actions. Let's find a place, at the United Nations or wherever else, and talk about it. Figure out how you can meet our concerns and how we could meet your concerns. That's what diplomacy has always been about. But George W. Bush thinks that, you can just do it with bluff and bluster and military force, and the military force that he used in Iraq has come back to bite the United States. And one of the things that I'm trying to do in the book, David, is to actually reformulate the concept of the national interest. So when I'm talking about, George W. Bush having harmed the national interest, I'm not talking about the profits of the multinationals. I'm not talking about, you know, what's good for GE is good for America. I'm talking about regular U.S. citizens.
Right.
And our interests around the world have been really harmed by George W. Bush. So, you know, the good news I can bring, because I have traveled a lot around the world since 9/11. I counted it up. I've been to 18 countries on five continents since 9/11. And I've talked, you know, because I'm a writer. I nose around. I talk to all kinds of people, not just cabinet ministers, but, you know, little girls in the street or the women selling in the market or, you know, just regular people as well as intellectuals and officials. And the vast majority of them want to have a good relationship with Americans. But it is the policies of our government that stands in the way of that. So, you know, we are lucky to have a democracy here still, despite all the, you know, attacks that the Bush administration has made on it. We've got a big chance to really, you know, get into our democratic debate for the rest of this summer and until the election and talk to our candidates and tell them we want a much better and more egalitarian and principled foreign policy.
You talk in the book, Helen, about a policy of global inclusion, and you repeat the phrase throughout, policies of inclusion. How are we to include people and countries? What is our policy now in that regard?
Well, I guess the first thing is, you know, we need to include ourselves in the human race, you know, because for the last, well, for a long time, let's face it, many Americans and certainly people in the political elite have had this idea of some kind of, you know, manifest destiny at a world level. You know, that not only in this country, on this continent, but also, you know, at the world level, we have this sort of manifest destiny to lead. And I remember President Clinton and Secretary of State Albright in the 1990s used to talk about, you know, we are the indispensable nation. People don't think that about us anymore, if they ever did. And,
you
know, they
want to... What that says about all the other nations. If our nation's indispensable, what are the others?
Well, they might be the dispensable ones, I guess, yeah.
Right.
But, you know, I think we still have, in a sense, because of, you know, our enormous financial and economic and military clout, a tremendous amount of responsibility to the rest of the world, but not to be the, you know, the one leading nation. It has to be more of a shared leadership model, and it has to be one that also seeks to include in global decision-making all those, you know, parties and movements and peoples and ethnic groups who have been excluded from any meaningful decision-making up until now. You know, 900 million people in sub-Saharan Africa who just always get the short end of the stick, whether it's trade or whether it's, you know, hurricane help, whether it's climate change help. You know, they are always at the end of the queue. We need to include them and include ourselves, but on a basis of really recognizing the essential equality of all human persons. And, you know, sometimes that seems like a really radical, crazy idea. You mean Americans are just as equal as everybody else in the world? But it is really a very ancient American idea as well. If you go back to the Declaration of Independence, if you go back to, you know, the founding principles of the United Nations, which was also a U.S. government creation at the end of the Second World War, a wonderful, you know, set of institutions and principles that the Bush administration, you know, whether it's with John Bolton or with anybody else, they have just trashed the United Nations. We need to re-engage with the United Nations first and foremost.
Helena, we're starting to get questions coming in through our chat room, through the internet, and let me pass this one along. Lawrence in Minnesota asks, "You sound a lot like Dr. Helen Caldicott. What is your nationality and your backgrounds? How did you come to be the writer, humanitarian you are?"
Oh, what an honor to be compared with Dr. Helen Caldicott. Thank you, Lawrence.
I would take that as a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I did grow up in England in the 1950s and 1960s at a time when we were going through a lot of change there, you know, from Britain thinking that it had this kind of manifest destiny to, you know, lead the British Empire and all the benighted nations around the world. And at that time in the 1950s and 1960s, wasn't a week or a month passed by, but a new nation in Africa or Asia would retake its independence, its rightful independence. And the British learned that letting go of the urge to control other peoples really was good for everybody. It was good for them, and it was good, obviously, good for the other peoples. So that was a very formative experience in my life. I came here to the United States in the early 80s, got married to a local chap, and we're still happily married, and became a U.S. citizen in 1987. So I have really appreciated the ability to, you know, become part of this citizenry here that is informed by these great ideals, and just want to hang on to that. There was a lot in Britain that I disliked when I left, you know, the class system and a lot of the remaining aspects of colonialism. So I was very disturbed when I came here, and, you know, I thought that the United States was this very idealistic place, and I still think it is, because you get outside the Washington Beltway, there's a tremendous amount of real energy and real concern and compassion. But, you know, I've lived inside of Washington, D.C., and I've lived outside of Washington, D.C. I think there's something strange happens to a person's brain when they come inside the Washington Beltway. You know, they get all these kind of very incestuous ideas. There's all these think tanks and the screeching heads that appear on television and tell us that, you know, well, we've got to go to war and we've got to do this and we've got to do that. This war has been a disaster for the American people. You know, it's cost $523 billion up until now. You know, if you think what we could have done, I'm just talking about the war in Iraq. If you think what we could have done with that $523 billion, and here's the thing, we didn't, you know, the people who paid for that, the people who financed it, were the Japanese and the Chinese, who hold the vast majority of the foreign holdings of U.S. T-bills. So, of course, you ask, why are the Chinese happy to have the Americans launch this war in Iraq? Well, you know, just think about it. American military power has been massively degraded there. And the Chinese end up holding, you know, controlling the dollar. It's kind of, it's the new world we're living in, where military power doesn't actually get you what you want around the world. The world is different now than the way it was in the 19th century. In the 19th century, you know, Britain or France or even Italy or Germany or those European powers or Japan, they could go to foreign countries and take them over, you know, and use some advanced weapons and kill hundreds of thousands of people, and nobody in the world would ever really learn about it. You know, word would trickle back to London or Paris that there was an uprising of, you know, the black people in this country or the brown people in that country, and nobody cared. But nowadays, you can't do that. The 21st century is a time when humanity is all, as I say, hyperlinked, you know, not just with the internet, but with so many ways. So we can't say that we don't know about the casualties of our wars overseas. And maybe some people can say that they don't care, but I'm not one of those. And the reason I care is partly because I am a Quaker, and I do believe there is a divine light in every human being, in every man, woman, and child on God's earth. But also, I don't want to live in a world where, because I have a white skin, I don't care about the fate of, you know, my many friends and colleagues around the world who have brown or black skins. I mean, I just really, I prefer to live in a world of equality.
We are speaking with Helena, I almost said Helen Caldicott. We're speaking with Helena Coban, the author of Re-Engage, America and the World After Bush. And this is the People Speak Radio, and you can call in and join our conversation toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. Or everywhere else in the world, 877-489-6350, 877-489-6350. And I have a ton of questions, but so do our listeners in the chat room. And let me go to this one. Doug in Canada asks, what do you think of the possibilities of a U.S. attack on Iran?
Well, good question, Doug. For a little period, I had a sort of a little clock on my blog in which I was trying to say, you know, what the possibility was of an attack on Iran. And right after the release of the National Intelligence Estimate last November, I thought the possibility had gone radically down. Recently, I'm seeing a lot more talk and a lot more concern that I think the probability of an attack on Iran has gone up recently. And I still think it would be disastrous in so many ways. The Iranians obviously are not going to just sit back and be attacked. They're not going to just, you know, take it to the United Nations. Any nation that is attacked militarily has the right to self-defense. And that would include such things as, for example, hitting the 160,000 American servicemen and women who were sitting like sitting ducks in Iraq at the end of extremely long and vulnerable supply lines. So they could just, you know, they could either attack some of those service members who were there. They could attack the supply lines, choke off the supply lines. They could do a number of different things throughout the Middle East that would obviously, in addition, affect global oil prices. And I think that's one of the underlying reasons for the current volatility in global oil prices, the reason that you and I all have to pay a whole lot more at the pump. Well, I would if I still had a car, but my husband has to pay a lot at the pump. Because people are worried about, you know, the unpredictability of President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney precisely on this issue. They are sort of like rogue elephants stomping around the world, causing a lot of real damage to people, but also causing a lot of fear and volatility in the oil markets. So it's a scary time. I still, on balance, don't think they'll do it, but I think the probability that they might has gone up in recent weeks, and that is a cause of huge concern.
How important in that regard do you think is the vote next week on money for the next year's worth of occupying Iraq, money which obviously could easily be taken and used for other dastardly things? And with regard to the occupation of Iraq itself, how important is it that Congress stop paying for it next week?
Well, I think it would be the most important thing that Congress could do would be to stop paying for this war in Iraq. Remember that, well, I know that you remember, David, back in November 2006 when we voted a new Congress, when we overturned the old order of things and that whole, you know, Newt Gingrich kind of...
We did anyway.
Well, we kind of did, but then the Democrats...
Tell me how. What changed?
Well, there's a few hearings that are being held from time to time that wouldn't have been held otherwise.
Yes, they're lovely hearings, and then they go have lunch and go home.
And vote for the money for the war, you know.
Vote for the money for the war and fail to impeach any of the people whose crimes they've exposed in the hearings. So, I mean, seriously, this is an important question to people in the peace movement is, what's the difference anymore? Because we look at Bush and Cheney and the disaster they've been, and we start to read books about how we'll try to recuperate in the post-Bush era, but we look at John McCain, and he looks at least as bad. And we look at Barack Obama, and we like to fill in this Rorschach test, where you fill in the nice things we can imagine about him, but the specifics that you've been talking about, you know, refusing to take the option of aggressively nuking Iran off the table and so forth, well, this is something that Barack Obama explicitly refuses to take off the table. This is someone who wants to significantly increase the size of our military, who's open to launching missile attacks into Pakistan and so on. How much should we be looking at the glass half full there? What's the real picture?
Well, I think the bottom line is that we can't expect anybody to come in on a white horse or a black horse and solve our problems for us. So as long as we keep up the pressure at the grassroots here in this country, and we need to do a whole lot more organizing than what has been done so far, then we can continue to put pressure on, you know, our members of Congress and our president to do the right thing. I mean, I remember when I first came to this country in the early 80s, there was the nuclear freeze movement. There was Dr. Helen Caldicott. There were those massive marches and demonstrations around the country for nuclear freeze. That's, you know, nobody's done that ever since. There was a large movement, mass movement in this country prior to the invasion of Iraq. And then, you know, I was part of that big demonstration in New York City in February of 2003. But once we sort of lost that one and Bush invaded Iraq anyway, my sense is that national anti-war coalition has been very, very disorganized. And, you know, we just all have to work at the grassroots, do what we can in, you know, 100 different ways to try and rebuild, you know, at the local level, at the state level, and keep the pressure on. Partly we can do it as American citizens, and partly the pressure will be coming from outside increasingly over the years ahead and from our allies overseas. And when I say allies, I mean, you know, people and governments around the world in that other 95% of humanity who are not going to let, you know, a George W. Bush launch a unilateral invasion of a country like this president did of Iraq, because they will be holding all our T-bills, you know. One of the things I remember when I grew up, I didn't remember it in person. I was only 4 years old. It was 1956, and the British and French thought that they would have, you know, one last imperial hurrah, and they invaded, along with Israel, they invaded Egypt, the Suez Canal, Sinai. And Eisenhower was completely correct on this issue. He saw that that was, number one, quite immoral, and number two, quite counterproductive for the real interests of the Western nations. And so he forced the British and the French to withdraw, and the way he did it was very simple. He just started selling the pounds that he you know, held, that the U.S. Treasury held, and forced the pound sterling to devalue until the British Prime Minister, it took about 3 days, said, oops, sorry, that invasion of Suez was all a terrible mistake, and we're just going to pull our troops home. Now, I don't expect that the Chinese and the Japanese who hold our T-bills these days are going to do exactly the same thing. But, you know, you can be absolutely sure that the next time a president wants to invade another country or to raise an additional, you know, 200,000 U.S. troops, that other countries are going to have something to say about it as well. And then the fact of the matter is, you know, Barack Obama can talk about raising additional troops. It's not going to solve anything. It's going to make things worse, because military power has actually become counterproductive in the present era. You know, you can bomb, you can strafe, you can set up these horrible, enormous concrete jersey barriers to make every little neighborhood of Baghdad into what they call a gated community. Well, it's more like an open-air prison. But it still doesn't solve your political problem. At the end of the day, they're going to have to go to the United Nations and negotiate a way for the U.S. troops to get out of Iraq. I just want that to happen sooner rather than later. I want it to happen in an orderly way rather than in a catastrophic way. And I want it to happen in a way that is generous to the Iraqi people, because we have really caused them so much suffering.
I want the same things, and I think most people around the world do too. Let's bring somebody in on this conversation. We have Mike from California on the line. Thanks for calling the People Speak Radio.
Thank you very much. Hello, Helena. You said you were from the UK, and I'm wondering, how different are the people in the UK from the United States? Are they a little bit more proactive? I remember when George Galloway came to the United States and went to D.C. and told off our Congress and Senate. If the politicians in the UK are like that, I wish he was running for president.
Well, yeah, George Galloway is really quite a remarkable person, quite prepared to speak his mind. There, you know, the parliamentary tradition there in Britain is very different from what happens in Congress here. I mean, there is much more kind of feisty to and fro, much more putting the government on the spot. They have this thing called Prime Minister's Question Time, you know, when any member of parliament can ask, you know, very pointed questions of the Prime Minister about this or that aspect of policy. And it's much more lively and there's much more accountability to the voters there. So I did hear that Barack Obama was thinking of introducing something like Prime Minister's Question Time. I guess it would be President's Question Time, but if he gets elected. How different? You know, they also had massive anti-war marches in Britain in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq. And there too, their leader, their national leader, Tony Blair, if you remember him, what a disaster he was, just, you know, completely defied the will of the people and went along with the will of George W. Bush instead. I used to have a lot of hope in the sanity and good, essential good nature and goodwill of the European countries. I'm a little less optimistic that they are going to save the world and save us Americans from ourselves. I'm less optimistic than I used to be. Right now, I see a lot of the European leaders kind of, you know, Tony Blair used to be Bush's lapdog, and then he was forced out in large part because of, you know, the British people really didn't like the role that he was playing with regard to Bush. And after that, you know, since that time, we've had Sarkozy from France and Angela Merkel from Germany and many other European leaders competing to be the lapdog of George Bush. It strikes me as very strange. I mean, I had hoped for more of a, you know, an independent, unified European position, and I'm a little bit mystified about why the Europeans are, you know, seem to have swung behind the George W. Bush agenda to this extent over the last 5 years, because, you know, back in 2003, they really were against it. But, you know, the whole world is changing. There's the rising powers, obviously, of China and India. Russia is getting, you know, much more stable and forceful than it was in the 1990s under that buffoonish President Yeltsin that they had. So we're in a time of great shift. And the one thing that I can say about it for certain is that there was this little organization in this country called the Project for a New American Century, which was basically all the neoconservatives. And, you know, they essentially won in the year 2000 when they managed to seize control of the presidency with their able helpers, George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. And so the victory of the Project for a New American Century led us into Iraq, led us to the massive debt and internal problems, economic problems that we have in this country right now, all the problems that the invasion caused around the world. And I think it hastened the end of the New American Century by approximately 93 years. You know, we are no longer top dog, and that is largely their doing. So now, you know, we need to roll up our sleeves, figure out how to build a new kind of relationship with the rest of the world. And from that point of view, I see it as a sort of a silver lining that we can get down off this mirage that people used to have, that we could be, you know, the manifest destiny nation, we could be the indispensable nation. No, we can't. And there's no reason that a nation of just 5% of the world's people should even aspire to be that. Let's be good citizens of the world. And we're going to need all the good citizenship in the world that we can muster with climate change and all these other new issues coming along.
We are, and we're going to need the next 20 minutes because I've got a million questions, but we're going to have to take a short break. We are speaking with Helena Coban, that's C-O-B-B-A-N, Helena Coban, who is the author of Re-Engage, America and the World After Bush. This is David Swanson at the People Speak Radio, and when we return, you can join us with your questions toll-free at 888-228-4494. And outside of the U.S. and Canada, 877-489-6350. We will be back in a few.
More than 1 million children are forced into prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. The economic difficulties contributes to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit SOSMorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
This is Gore Vidal. Can you name the one country on earth where the government can steal elections, strip away basic rights, spy on civilians, launch wars based on lies, and where the people do not take over the nation's capital in protest? If you said the United States, you'd be right. So let's remedy that by calling our Congress members and asking them to support the impeachment of George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
This land is yours.
Join us on the People Speak Radio Show every Tuesday and Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern for an hour of live interview and audience interaction with guests from the realms of entertainment, education, activism, spirituality, politics, and literature. Get involved and make a difference for the better. That's the People Speak every Tuesday and Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio Network.
And we are back on the People Speak Radio. This is David Swanson and our guest for the next 20 minutes. We are very privileged to have with us Helena Coban, the author of a book you need to go buy called Re-Engage, America and the World After Bush. Let me just touch on a few topics that we've hit on that I had further questions on, Helena. One is you said that unlike, you know, the 19th century, when we go and we fight a war and we kill people, we know it. But I'm not 100% convinced of that because, you know, every serious study I've seen puts the death count in Iraq somewhere over a million. It's commonly referred to in U.S. Major media outlets as 100,000 or 50,000 or 30,000. And I've seen polls of the American public where a majority put it under 10,000. So to what degree do we know? And what do you say the casualty count is in Iraq?
That's a really good question. I have lived in a war zone, and I understand that it's extremely difficult to count the civilian casualties of war. And in fact, you know, there are different ways, there are different things that people count. There is this organization called the Iraq Body Count that produces the most conservative and consistently conservative figures for the civilian casualties of war. And their methodology is extremely tight, that they will only count those casualties that are casualties of direct physical violence, you know, that is a bomb or a hand grenade or a gun or something, whose death has been recorded by two separate media sources. Well, you know, how much media is there in some of these places where the U.S. military and other actors are rushing around with their machine guns? That's the first thing. And then the second thing is that it is well known that when you have the disruptions of a war, like particularly in Iraq, disruption in the water system, you have to understand that most of the people of Iraq live in the valleys of the Tigris and Euphrates, and if you wreck the safe water system upstream, then basically you get all kinds of diseases, many of them fatal diseases, going downstream. And that is precisely what's been happening in Iraq. I mean, I think the vast majority of what you could say as the casualties of war have been probably children and sick people and old people, everybody who is weak in society, who has died of diarrhea in a completely, you know, diarrhea that could have been prevented if the water system had been kept safe and clean and intact. But the war and the collapse of the government has been responsible for that. That doesn't show up on anybody's death counts apart from this big epidemiological study that was done a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, I guess, by the people from Johns Hopkins. They used the same methodology that they use, you know, in the Democratic Republic of Congo and other chronic war zones, and they came up at that time with 600,000. So I tend to think that if you want to really think of, you know, who are the Iraqi casualties of this war, think of a child who's dying of diarrhea and then multiply that by 600,000 or perhaps as many as 1 million. But honestly, we cannot count. So when I say that, you know, nowadays the casualties are known, you're right, David, they are not perfectly known. They are not perfectly understood. But they aren't completely hidden, either from the U.S. public. You know, a member of the U.S. public who wants to find out about this stuff can get online or go to the local library and find out about it. In the 19th century, you couldn't even do that, you know, in Britain or in France. They had nice public libraries, but, you know, it wasn't reported in the newspapers. There was no internet. People just didn't know about the entire genocide, for example, of the Herero people in southern Africa by the Germans. They didn't know about so much of the stuff that was going on. Nowadays, Americans who want to know can find out a large degree of the information. And the other important aspect of this is that the other 6 billion people around the world, many of whom are a lot more concerned about these casualties than Americans, they know about them too. So they know things about the effects of our military action that perhaps many Americans don't choose to know. But that means that, you know, there's a whole lot of people around the world amongst those 6 billion who are extremely angry at us, and with reason.
With good reason. I think people who get their news from ABC News do not know any of what you've just described. People who go to your website, justworldnews.org, or other useful websites, can find it out. But I want to switch topics a little bit, because it was you touched on this in passing, that when you were younger in the UK, Britain was sort of giving up its empire, and that was a good thing. It actually benefited the people of what Bush would call the homeland. And a lot of people in America today don't see that as an option. They understand that our luxuries and privileges come from exploiting other people and controlling oil and so forth around the world. And so if we are to give up our empire, how in the world can we expect to be better off? Now, maybe we should do it, and it's going to require sacrifices. But can we really give up the empire and have not just people outside of the homeland, but people here in the homeland actually be as well off or better off than we were when we were bossing the world around?
Undoubtedly we can, David. For starters, there's 4,000 85 families in this country who have lost a family member because of this insane idea that you can go around and control the whole of the rest of the world, including invading Iraq. And scores of thousands of families with family members coming home maimed for life, whether, you know, physically or mentally. And these people are already with us in our communities. We see some of them in Charlottesville. We see some of them, you know, whenever you go to a major city, you see the wounded coming back from Iraq. That is just the tip of the iceberg of the cost of this idea of seeking to control the rest of the world. You know, another part of it is that as an American citizen, I do like to travel around the world. I do like to go and see my friends. I don't like traveling, you know, by air these days and going through all this ridiculous, you know, hyper-security stuff, because there are people out there who hate us. Yes, there are, but they have reason. Now, you know, you or I might say that that's no reason to go out and be, you know, undertake terrorist acts. But I have talked to people, I have talked to refugees from Iraq, in Syria, and in Jordan, and to hear their stories of what happened to their family members and their neighborhoods and their communities under the effects of the war, you know, it's tragic stuff. And you can see why somebody, in particular a young man or a young woman from those communities, who just, you know, says, to hell with it, I'm going to go out and kill Americans. And so, you know, the world is going to be a lot safer if we as Americans can find a new relationship, a new way to deal with these people. You know, one of my big other experiences that has shown me that transformations in relationships really are possible is the work I've done with South Africa and in South Africa. You know, when I was growing up in England, I never dreamt that Nelson Mandela would be free. I mean, Nelson Mandela was like, he was my icon in the 60s. That was what got me engaged in international affairs in the first place, was the anti-apartheid issue in South Africa. I never dreamt that apartheid could be ended. And it was. You know, in a period of 2 years, from 1990, well, 2 or 3 years, from 1990 to 1994, once the white South Africans realized that their attempt to control the rest of their compatriots, who happen not to be white, but that they could actually sit down with them and deal with them and negotiate with them. You know, they used to call Nelson Mandela a terrorist. They used to call the ANC, all of them, terrorists. How can we talk to the terrorists, they would say. Just the same kind of thing that George W. Bush says now. Then they set up this negotiation, and they found that it was possible to talk to them, to resolve the issues, and to build a new order built on equality. And we can do that. I mean, I see us a little bit like the white South Africans, you know, in our relationship with the rest of the world, except that the white South Africans were 11% of that community. We are only 5% of humanity. So, you know, the idea that we can control the rest of humanity is ludicrous.
It is, but that doesn't stop it being passed around in Washington, D.C. I want to bring up, for people who haven't read your book and who get their news from American television, you know, China plays a major role in a thoughtful look like yours at future foreign affairs. And if I'm remembering right, it was not very long before September 11th, 2001, that you would hear the right-wing radio hosts sort of priming China as our new enemy, because, you know, we really needed an enemy after the Cold War, and then we were given this gift of, you know, Al-Qaeda slash Saddam Hussein as an enemy, and China was off the radar screen, and we were borrowing our grandchildren's, our great-grandchildren's unearned money from China that we'll have to pay back with interest to go and fight these other enemies. What's going to come of that? In the end, how are we ever going to pay that back, and what is our relationship going to be like with a nation that we owe this much money to?
Well, you're quite right to recall that prior to 9/11, Cheney was definitely itching for a confrontation with China. And there was that incident, if you remember, with the American plane that flew inside Chinese airspace and was brought down on Hainan Island. And, you know, as you say, the right-wing screeching heads were out there raring to go. I mean, things have changed so radically in the last 7 years. American power around the Pacific Rim, the East Asian Rim of the Pacific, has eroded considerably, and Chinese power has expanded. Now, what kind of power? Soft power. That is the surprising thing, because, you know, Americans tend to think that China just has, I don't know, human resource power. But they don't think that that China has soft power. It has tremendous soft power. What I mean by soft power is the reputation of a country. And I do go into this quite a bit in the book. And I make the argument that because of modern communications, military power is far less important and far less useful than it used to be. And soft power or reputational power is far more important. Now, for many Americans, the idea that China could have a good reputation and, you know, good, strong alliances with other countries based on mutual interest and principle is quite foreign, because Americans like to think, gee, our way of life is the best in the world. Everybody must want to be just like us. Well, guess what? You know, we're looking at these pictures now from Sichuan province where something like 70,000 Chinese have died in these earthquakes. And nearly all the pictures and nearly all the stories are telling us that the Chinese government and people are doing a tremendous job looking after their people. And, you know, just 2.5 years ago, all around the world, people were looking at the pictures and the stories of the absolute fiasco in New Orleans. I think, you know, from my conversations with many non-Americans around the world, that was such an important moment when they suddenly saw this idea that, you know, America has all the answers and they can't even look after their own people in one city. I mean, that punctured a whole lot of our reputation around the world, and we still haven't dug out of that one.
And yet it is hard to imagine any president of any party, future or past, handling something like Hurricane Katrina, the lead up to it and the response to it over the past years, anywhere near as badly as the current president. And the current president, you know, you could make a case as an American traveling abroad who didn't want to get slapped around that the Supreme Court did it the first time. Well, the second time, I don't know your opinion on the matter, but I have no doubt that the election was stolen, but it was close enough to be stolen, and most of the media claims and most of the world believes that Americans actually elected this guy to a second term. So if we were to have any sort of ability to show our face with dignity to people around the world, I would think it would be if we held this president and his vice president and crew accountable through impeachment, through indictment, through prosecution. And I would think if we have any chance of preventing an attack on Iran, it's not going to be with letters from Senator Webb that please don't attack Iran. It's going to be by starting to hold Bush and Cheney accountable for what they've already done. How important in the end do you think that is, that anyone be held accountable for what's for Abu Ghraib, for Gitmo, for Iraq, for Katrina, and so on?
Well, I guess I think that it's most important in life to stop the commission of harm. And that after you've stopped the harm being done, then you can think about going back and cleaning up the mess that results. Now, personally, right now, I don't see a chance that we're going to be able to impeach George Bush. And I think the energy needs to go into trying to figure out what comes on January 20th, 2009. That you and I probably disagree about that, David. But How we can hold these guys accountable? Well, the first thing we need to do is to stop, to reverse the policies that have been so disastrous. The first thing is, you know, if I were advising the next president, and I'm happy to offer my advice for nothing, it would be this. In the first 100 days, you have to close Guantanamo Bay. You have to get back into the negotiations on the post-Kyoto climate change business. And you have to declare a date by which all American troops will be out of Iraq. And on that basis, the American government can deal with the rest of the world in a completely new way. And then, you know, let's hope we can go back and shovel away some of the excrement that has been placed on our record by President Bush and Vice President Cheney. I'm sure there's a lot of tricks that they will use to avoid being held accountable, but there are probably ways to do it. But the first thing is to stop the harm. And so, you know, I think we need to keep up the pressure. We need to have the discussions during the election campaign. Now that we're virtually in the general election campaign right now, we need to ask the questions, you know, how are we going to stop the harm? What are you going to do in the first 100 days?
Well, I agree. I'm worried about the next 8 months as well. But we're running over our allotted time. But I want, if you're willing, Helena, to turn to one more topic, which is global warming or climate change. Take your pick. What role does this play in the grand scheme of foreign relations in the coming years?
I think it's going to become, or maybe has already become, the new nuclear weapons as an issue of grave importance in diplomacy. Like, nuclear weapons and climate change, both of them threaten the whole of the human race. They threaten the whole of life on our planet. So they really call on us, you know, both these issues, to pull together as the human race, to figure out, you know, how we're going to ramp down these nuclear arsenals, of which, of course, ours here in the United States is by far the biggest and most threatening to other people, and how to ramp down our tremendously wasteful and harmful use of hydrocarbons and puffing out of carbon dioxide emissions. My son is an environmental engineer, and I think, you know, where the future lies is in transforming economies so that they don't need to run on hydrocarbons. There's an enormous amount of technological innovation that needs to happen, but government needs to guide that in the same way that they guided, for example, the innovation that put a man on the moon or the innovation that led to nuclear bombs or whatever in an earlier era. So it's a huge challenge, but it will also require that we change our relationship with the rest of the world. One of the worst things that I've seen this past year has been these subsidies going to U.S. farmers to take perfectly good agricultural land out of the production of foodstuffs and into the production of fuels for people's SUVs. And this at a time when food prices were anyway going up around the world. Now we are literally taking food out of the mouths of people in Haiti, in Egypt, in India, in sub-Saharan Africa. And we're putting that fuel into our SUVs. I mean, to me, that is the height of selfishness. And we're going to have to just completely change our way of doing those things. And, as I say, get re-included with the rest of humanity as, yes, we're here. We're going to pull up, roll up our sleeves and work on these issues alongside you rather than tell the rest of the world what to do.
Well, it seems like the right idea to me, and one we don't have much choice about, I'm afraid. This is what I like about your book, Helena, is that you turn to economics, to poverty, to immigration, to terrorism, and show how all of these issues are related and how we need a quite different comprehensive approach to the world. I highly recommend that everyone get a copy of this book and get one for your friends and get one or your neighbor who still waves a flag every time the president burps. This is called Re-Engage, America and the World After Bush by Helena Coben. Helena, thanks for taking the time to be with us this evening.
Great talking to you, David. You take care.
You too. And this is David Swanson at the People Speak Radio. You can visit us at thepeoplespeakradio.net, where you can contribute what we need to keep this show going, and that is dollars, weekend or otherwise. We need them. And on Tuesday, the guest on the program will be Tim Robbins, and on Wednesday, an inspiring and progressive candidate for Congress by the name of Byron DeLeer. Speak with you next week.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea, by the relief of that summer people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours, man. This land is mine, land from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.